Anyway, right, so yeah, cheers for coming down. This is a Radical History Group event. I usually make a joke about fire safety. Door, sorry. The toilet's out the back and the light is the third one to the left on the outside of the door. That's about it really. Any other health and safety? No? Okay. Let's check the unions and all that. Right, just want to say, Ben Tillett, I didn't really know anything about Ben Tillett until a few years ago. No idea about his connection to Bristol or anything like that. So how I came across Ben Tillett really was when a plaque went up on Bannerman Road in Easton, which unfortunately I wasn't at the unveiling, but I was shown it on a history walk by Jim McNeil and Mike Baker, it must be 10 years ago now, I reckon, showed us the plaque, and so I didn't realise, because Mike Baker said to me that the plan for doing the plaques in Easton, that Living Easton did, the Time Signs Trail, was to... It's because we're not really interested, as Mike Baker said, in people who were born with a silver spoon in their mouth. We're interested in people who came from supposedly ordinary backgrounds but did extraordinary things. And Ben Tillett is kind of one of those people. So really pleased today to have Jim. I think you worked on this many years ago.
Yeah, it was unveiled in 2000.
2000, yeah. So the work was done then. But. Jim's just produced two pamphlets, which we're going to launch over the next month or so. The first one on Ben Tillett, the second one on William Penn. So if you want to read the full story, they're here and they're a couple of quid or three for a five, or you negotiate the meals or something. So I definitely recommend it. I've had a look at it, and it doesn't pull any punches, which is Jim's style in general anyway. So that's about all I've got to say, except that... this event is, this event, like all Bristol Radical History events, we're not funded by any political parties, businesses, universities or anything like that. And so we rely on you buying our pamphlets and making your donation. So I suspect at the end, this cap, this is a weathered cap, will be going round for some coins. Anyway, I'll leave Steve with that.
Cheers. Good afternoon, everybody.
Afternoon.
Good morning, campers.
You've got to buy a pamphlet before you leave.
I bought one.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I'd just like to thank Mr. Radical History Group for publishing the pamphlet. And in particular, Rich, for all the work he does on the editing side of it. And also the crew and the volunteers at Hyder Bookshop for hosting this event. Thanks very much. So it's about five parts. Short, I'll give a brief account of his life and his politics. Of a significant trade union leader, Ben Tillett. Now, the dock strikes in 1889 in London and Bristol, and also the 1892 strike, which was fearsome in Bristol. The development of Avonmouth, and in the 1910 dock strike, and a couple of others after that as well, leading up to the First World War. Tillett's role in the First World War in the TUC, and wasn't adrift, it was a stampede in the right, really. And then discussion. That's okay. If you've got any questions, you can ask them as we go along, or I can note them and answer them at the end. So Ben Tillett, there he is, bonny lad, handsome man. What a waif, a foundling really. Quite a little foundling now. He was a waif and a womanizer. Incredibly active man, incredibly driven as well. He had affairs, he had a mistress in Australia, he had a secret life. And after his second wife died, he had another affair during that time. Quite a guy. Bit like you up today. Okay, so he was born in 1860, died in 1943. He was 83-year-old when he died. So he covered a lot of periods of history. The transition from Victorian times to pretty much modern times, or the Second World War. And that's the plaque that was unveiled and designed and made by Mike Baker, who lives in Eastern, and he made it in Ward's Foundry in Barton Hill. This is the only foundry left in the area. It was unveiled by Bill Morris, who was then the ex-General Secretary of the T&G and the first Black Trade Union leader in the country. I'm very proud of that, it was a great day. Okay, so, Bintulet. He was born in Easton, in John Street, which is now demolished. He was right beside the Easton Pit, Easton Coal Mine, in 1860.
What was that?
It's just off Bannerman Road, Eastern Road, behind the Queen's Head. I'll mention all the pubs you know, you know where I'm. Turn round and blow over the Queen's Head and just on.
Sorry, Roger.
Yeah. Corn Factory Lane, it's on the corner of Corn Factory Lane. His dad was actually a comb maker, as well as other jobs, and he picked up jobs here, there, and everywhere. He was the last of eight children. I think a few died as well, so there was eight survived, and so two down house in John Street in Easton, eight kids. His mum died when he was quite young, but there was 10 of them living there, plus he had lodgers with their family, all living in a two up two down house. And if you look at the occupancy of the houses in Easton at that time, you had extended families, you had, you know, grandparents down to little kids, all living in one house, 16, 19 people in one of those little houses, not unusual. Pre-pill. So that's where he was born. So he was born right next to this pit, 1,000 foot deep, this coal mine. And he was born in 1860. The heyday of that pit was He was born in 1860. The heyday of that pit was the 1870s. And when he was brought up, he worked around here. He ran away from home twice before he was seven. He ran away at the circus, and he was always fascinated by performance and circus and stuff like that. And and he worked in the local brickyards when he was 7 years old for a pittance. And all the children worked. Men and boys worked down that mine, and I worked in a mine one time in North Yorkshire. That was 1,000 foot deep, and that's the deepest mine in Europe, and they did it by hand with picks and shovels. And it is hot down there. The rock is hot because you're getting closer and closer to the mantle. Very thin earth crust we got. Men and boys worked there. Women and girls worked on the top, and they sorted out the coal and did other jobs, handled the timber, and also used the timber and turned it timber props, the old props, and turned it into firewood and sold the sticks around Easton and elsewhere. So everybody worked. You can see they delivered it Clifton and things down in the lower parts of the city. So he was born in 1860. In 1886, when he came back to Bristol at the time of strikes, there was a major disaster there where 13 miners died because they were sent into what's called a fiery vein for methane and all the Abbas candles. And W.G. Grace, the cricketer, he was the local doctor. We got a plaque to him as well at Stapleton Road outside the leisure centre, the swimming class. And he was the local doctor and he came. And the mortuary is still there. Hemings Waste, people know Hemings Waste? Yeah. They started up, they got the original contract to haul the coal from that mine. That was the first time Hemings existed. And Hemings still have their office there. But recently, 100 years on. It closed in 1911. Okay. So, a bit about Ben, give you an idea of what he was like. So yeah, he worked in the brickyard when he was seven. He was fascinated by the theatre, and one day when he was 13, his dad came to the theatre in central Bristol, dragged him out and dragged him down to the Naval Recruitment Office and signed him up for the Navy at 13 years old. And he says that the young lads, well, were abused and beaten. I don't know if they were sexually abused, quite possibly, on the naval ships. And he said that's how he learned to organise, and he understood the power of organisation to combat the naval authorities, to protect themselves, to get enough to eat, etc. on board ships. he had a rupture when he was 16, and he left the Navy, and he signed up in the Merchant Navy, and he went all over the world. He went to the Americas, West Indies, the Baltic, and European ports. Riga, was it Riga, Niger?
Riga,
other places on it. Tom, look, read later. And so he was well travelled, and he met a lot of people, and all the time he had an international perspective on the trade union work that he developed. When he joined the Merchant Navy, he lived in Bethnal Green in the East End of London, and became a Westmont. And he got a job as a boot and shoe maker. He was one of the trades he learned as a little boy, because boot, shoe and boot around here was a very big industry. And he used some of those skills, and he got a job in the factory there. But soon he became a tea cooper, making the barrels for tea. When they came in from the docks, in the London docks, he was unloaded, put in the barrels, and then shipped to the merchants. And from that, he became a member of the Tea Cooper and General Labourers Union. And by the time he was 27, he became its General Secretary at the age of 27. Yeah. That was the following that then developed into the Dock Wharf and Riverside Union. That took us down. And the tea coopers and general labourers were one of the main unions on the docks in London. And in 1889, the dockers went on strike. The whole of the port of London in the end, including Tilbury and Essex, came out on strike. And time will tell. Yeah. And, and took the trade union leaders, including Tilbury, totally by surprise. They were totally unprepared for the strike. And it was a famous strike for the dockers' tanner. Anybody heard of that? The dockers' tanner strike? Mega famous, sort of legendary in trade union history in the UK. And it's a huge event. After that strike, which I'll talk about later and in the next part of the talk, he formed, with Tom Mann, another famous trade union leader, he formed this Dock, Wharf, Riverside and General Labourers Union. It's important, but it wasn't just dockers, it was also the people who worked on the wharves, but also the people who worked with small craft on the rivers off London and off all the other ports, and also the general labourers. And this was the big start of general, unskilled, not craft unions, but the general mass working class numbers of people. It became known as the Dockers Union. He and Tom Mann, I mean, they had to fight the craft unions to get themselves respected and acknowledged, and they weren't just Johnny come here at this time. And he and John Mann had this motto, a nation made free by love, a mighty brotherhood linked by a jealous interchange of good. Which I think pretty much sums up his Christian socialist approach to trade unionism, which still runs all the way through the Labour Party today, all that Christian socialism and Methodism, etc. So Tillett was a teetotaler and a Christian socialist. I think he kept his Christian socialism, but he definitely lost his teetotalism.
Thanks to that.
And then in 1889, it's a brief overview, he came to Bristol, where the place of his birth, and he helped organise a great labour uprising, which included the Barton Hill cotton workers' strike, called the Cotton Girls' Strike. 75% of the workers in the cotton works were women. And then 3 years later, he led the Bristol Dock Strike, and he was arrested after this demonstration, the Lantern Parade, which was disrupted and they were beaten up by the police, and then the cavalry charged people on Bristol Bridge.
Was that led by Sir John Wills, the cavalry?
Yeah, it was, yeah. Who then led the prosecution of the people on the demonstration. It was a magistrate as well. Four years later, he was arrested and tried in London for incitement to riot. 4 years later, he was arrested in Belgium for trade union agitation. Now, what had happened is that some of the members of the Dockers Union, Tom Mann and others, had gone to Belgium to organise the dock workers there. Because you can see the link the ships came from, I suppose. And very internationally focused. They've been arrested and deported by the Belgian authorities for trade union organisation in Belgium. So Tillet went, because they weren't allowed back in the country. So Tillet went over, and he started agitating, and he wasn't allowed to participate in any demonstration at all. So they held a public demonstration, and he went along as a member of the public, just happened to be at the front of it. So he was duly arrested, banged in prison. He always had bad health, right from an early age, and that affected his health just that one day in the Belgian nick. And he was escorted to a ship and sent back to England. And then he tried with the British state to get compensation for the damage to his health and the old inconvenience of being arrested. And from then he went to Australia to recover his health. He was one of three trips he made to Australia. And a lot of trade union leaders at that time went to Australia to organise on that. And that's where he met his first musical to know his secrets. So that was 1887 he went to Australia, being arrested in Belgium. In 1890 and 1911, he led the most fierce strikes in full. And a couple of old pamphlets here. There's the East Yorkshire History Society or something. And the whole strikes of 1911 were really, really good read. And the trade and shipping in the 19th century hall. And you can get them on the internet, sell them on eBay. Really good books. So he made a speech in Hull 2 years later, coming back from Australia. It was to an unemployed demonstration. And in it he said, would it be any more murder to rise up and cut the throats of the rich? Than the rich, this isn't Ian Bourne. Would it be any more murder to rise up and cut the throats of the rich than the rich would be legalised to torture the poor and the vilest agonising death of all, that of starvation? There must come a day when the poor cut some throats. So he wasn't beating about the bush, what he was saying at all. And because of that, the local superintendent of the police in the hall, local MP, various councillors, went to the Home Office and was trying to get him arrested, but he beat it because he couldn't actually prove incitement to violence. Then he wrote the whole speech out in the journal as well. So The main, one of the important things, and it's quite interesting here, what the Wobblies, one big union, very, very keen on getting unions to join together. Very, 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 very keen. A lot of the general trade unions were. They could see the benefit of all unions joining together, and also on an international perspective. But he also, especially after his visit to Australia, he promoted state arbitration of industrial disputes. He had a lot of confidence in the state. The state could be an independence between the employer and the employee. He vacillated on that, but that was his general direction. And he used that. You can see it today in the tax grabber dispute in the state. Well, do you support the Unison members then, who pay your bloody wages?
Well, we prefer them not to strike.
You've all heard them on the radio, they're all moving around this country. Similar kind of thing. And he gradually turned against his members and done official strikes, just like any good union bureaucrat today.
Oh, I don't give
up. I'll go back to work now once I've got out the office. Go back to work. Go back to work. That was the first thing I remember when I was pretty active in trade unions. But no. Go back to work, and then we'll talk. How is that? More chance of being listed. In 1911, there were strikes all across the country. In Hull, there was insurrection. And he promoted state mediation. And he really came in. The border trade. Mediators. An insurrection, they were going to burn all the docks down. And Hull was the third biggest dock in the country after Liverpool in London. And they burnt all the buildings down. And he was seen as a close safe man by 1911. He was 51. Before the First World War, he, like a lot of trade union socialist leaders, were anti-war. But as soon as the war came, he then said that the war was a really, really good idea. And it should be supported. He was still ruled by Germany and trucks and other manufacturers. He didn't beat them. British state of invasion. In 1917, he was against the Russian Revolution. In 1919, after the war, he worked against the Triple Alliance, which was an alliance of the railway workers, the miners, and the transport workers. Like one of them went on tonight for Woodersford support, the support of the workers. A really powerful thing. And that miners strike in the 1980s, that was muted again. Everybody remembers that. But the miners came out when the transport and railway came out to support. It didn't happen. During that time, the Triple Alliance, because he was losing influence within what was then the TNG, the Transport and General Working Union, he was suspected of passing information to the government about the plans for the general strike before the First World War. His health continued to fail. In 1921, the TNG amalgamated all its sections, so he was in charge of the section within the Transport and General Workers. And all those sections amalgamated into one proper union, then he lost his influence. His circle of influence. And it was more and more side around by Bedding. We came from the group side around here and lived in Bristol. The two Bristol associations of the team. So he lost his power base. He was also a founder member of the Independent Labour Party, one of the founder members of the Daily Herald. The Labour Party newspaper that had to start that as a strike broadsheet. He became more inclined to be an MP than a trade union leader, and his MP for Salford in the 1920s. And in 1923, there is some evidence that he was actually taking money from on an annual basis from the Tory party. Partly for his he had all his connections through the First World War, when the trade union leaders worked very closely with the government to maintain production within the country. He made a lot of connections, and after the war, he used those connections to pass information to the government to spike any industrial or national action of the revolutionary movement. Sorry. In 1926, obviously, he was against the general strike. He brought it on board at the sensation in the TUC. After that, it became a sort of dwindling light and came to know the trade unions stating that he brought it up. Things he became quite kind of sort of bitter, taciturn, funny character. He died in 1943, 83-year-old, and we carried a big funeral in London, so he went to TUC. Quite a few other people went to his funeral, so that's Ben Tillett. Fiery fella, he wanted to cut people's throats. To somebody who said no, why cut the butcher's throat, that's just send it all up to Germany or Flanders and get lunch. So that presents it. Fascinating character. Second part, you enjoy that?
Yes.
Okay, the doctor's right.